Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
If I could turn back time, if I could find a way, I'd take back those words that hurt you, and you'd stay.
Turning back time to a little music from 1989. Yes, that is Cher. In the year this show was born. Also one of the most pivotal years of the 20th century, both globally and locally. It was the year that communism collapsed country by country around Eastern Europe, and the year that New York City instituted a whole new system of democracy here after its old one was thrown out as unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court. Never mind that it may not have been a stellar year for pop songs. Periodically this year, we will connect some of the history-altering events of 1989 to what's happening now in a 20th anniversary series, and we'll begin right now with economist Simon Johnson. As chief economist of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, he kept his eye on the transition to capitalism in the former Soviet world. Now it is capitalism that may be collapsing in its own right in Eastern Europe, perhaps the hardest hit part of the world in the financial crisis so far. This is the second of three visits from Simon Johnson this month to explain some of the fundamentals of the changing economy. He writes the blog, The Baseline Scenario, which includes the very useful section called The Financial Crisis for Beginners. He also teaches at MIT and the Peterson Institute for Economics. And one of his blog posts last week, by the way, warned that Europe's problems will soon come washing up at our shores, so don't get smug about what's going on over there. Simon, thanks again for doing this series, and welcome back to WNYC.
Nice to be back with you.
Where were you in 1989? Already at the IMF?
No. I was just finishing a postdoctoral fellowship at Harvard, and I went to work in Poland, actually, in September 1989, and early October, right when they were starting to try and put together a reform package, and it wasn't clear that communism had really fallen. You know, some cracks had appeared. This is before the Berlin Wall came down.
Yes.
So those were quite exciting days.
Yes, the Berlin Wall came down in November of that year. So what did you do there? What was your role?
Well, I was working with Professor Jeffrey Sachs, who, you know, has obviously become very well known and somewhat controversial. He has a great reputation among many Polish people, and he worked closely with the government, and I was a very junior member of his team, looking at, if you can believe this, the banking crisis.
The banking crisis of 1989, what was that?
It was it had some parallels with the banking crisis of 2009, I would suggest. Obviously, it was about the transition away from communism and the fact the banks had a lot of bad loans due to that. And also they had an hyperinflation or an incipient or almost hyperinflation that really messed up the banks' balance sheet. So, again, they needed to sort of transform themselves and make themselves into, you know, proper, privately run, sensible banks, just like our banks need to do.
What was a bank under communist economics? Was it much different from a bank in the West?
Well, here's another somewhat humorous or rather sad parallel. If you go back before the reforms started, so in 1989 Poland already had a bunch of reforms, but if you went back to the 1970s, or if you looked at the Soviet Union, and I actually did an attempted project in the Soviet Union, as it was then in the summer of 1990, these countries, before they were reformed, had just one bank. In the Russian, it was called Gosbank, or the state bank. And that bank was an integrated central bank and commercial bank. So it did everything from retail loans to loans for business to all this sort of usual central banking functions. Under communism, those are a little bit strange. And the humorous or sad part of it is, of course, that the Federal Reserve right now in the United States is taking on, which is traditionally just a central bank, it's taking on an enormous amount of commercial banking function. So in a sense, we're creating a kind of Gosbank in the United States, which I can assure you no one would have expected in 1989 or even in 2007.
I guess not. And Simon, I didn't realize that you worked with Jeffrey Sachs. And of course, he was so well known at that time, really, I guess, in the early 90s, working with Poland, creating what they called shock therapy to dismantle the welfare state and make the country market-oriented and market-dependent. And Jeffrey Sachs is controversial today for other reasons, very, very almost opposite reasons, but he was controversial at the time for his advocacy of such a rapid shredding of the safety net. correct?
I agree with everything you said up to that last clause. It wasn't the rapid shredding of the safety net. I think the safety net had already disintegrated under communism. So I remember being there in September 1989 and you know, living in an apartment and talking to friends, Polish friends, about what was going on. And, you know, the entire social fabric, the way that people earned money and lived, it had basically broken down because of the way communism had been run and because of the way reforms had been completely botched. So I think the idea that Jeff Sachs had, and others, and you know, he was working very closely with Leszek Balcerowicz, who was the finance minister, who went on to many distinguished roles in Poland, and is still, I think, one of the clearest thinkers about East European transition and the global economy. Their idea was that you had to break with the past relatively cleanly and move on as fast as possible. And if you did various kinds of gradual, partial, incremental reforms and changes, it would all get messed up, it would all get corrupted and stolen away. And I think, my read of the situation, looking back, I've done lots of retrospective studies there and elsewhere, is that they were basically right on that key intuition. But it does remain controversial.
Is that another strange parallel with today? Because when you were here last week, you were advocating a pretty quick nationalization of the banks, get the bad assets off their books, start them out as, in effect, new companies that can start over and become profitable. Is that the shock therapy of today instead of all this gradualism that's letting Citibank and everything else kind of slowly sink into the muck?
There are some parallels, definitely. And I'm certainly on the side of people who think we should, you know, do what needs to be done and get it out of the way. I think there's also some differences. First of all, I think the banks have substantially been nationalized in this country in the sense that the government has a lot of control over who gets to be the CEO. For example, the government appointed or reappointed Vikram Pandit as CEO of Citigroup about 2 weeks ago. And they put in the head of AIG as well.
The government did that?
Oh, yes, you did. You missed that piece of news? they kind of snuck that one through. That was when they announced that they were going to be converting their preferred shares into common equity. The Treasury said, and this is reported in the New York Times, the Treasury said that Vikram Pandit will stay on as CEO. And I immediately called a friend of mine in the New York Times and said, are you really sure this is what they said? Because this is an extraordinary statement. Where does the government get the legal authority to appoint the CEO of any private company? And the explanation was, of course, that the government sees itself now as the dominant shareholder in Citigroup, and dominant shareholders definitely get to decide who's going to be CEO. So that's a form of nationalization, and that's, if you like, a disintegration of the old system. I think the difference, to me at least, from the Polish situation in 1989 is, sooner or later, we have to deal with this banking situation. I mean, the gradualism isn't really an answer. Perhaps we'll get lucky. Perhaps it's sort of stalling for resurrection. If we wait around long enough, things will get better and the banks will take care of themselves. But I think that's not a very sensible approach, particularly when you see the kinds of problems coming at us from the global economy.
And we'll talk about how the Eastern Europe situation today connects with the American situation today in a minute. But just to digress for one second, of course, there was this good news from Citibank yesterday about a two-month period of being in the black, and we saw the Dow shoot up almost 400 points as a result. Do you think that that's like fool's gold?
I don't think it's fool's gold. I'm sure there's some reality there. But, of course, the real issue is that the economy continues to deteriorate, and that will cause losses on loans. And when you're a bank, it's easy to – and what you do is you book the business, your new loans. Initially, they look good, and then they start to deteriorate, and those are the losses that you then have to recognize and eventually replenish your capital to provision against. So that's sort of the nature of banking is that they're going to give you these positive signs from time to time, and you shouldn't get too excited about it.
My guest, economist Simon Johnson, the second of his three weekly visits here, 3 weeks in a row here on WNYC. And we're going to open up the phones. I wonder, since we're talking about the history of Eastern Europe 20 years ago and connecting it to the banking crisis today and the economic crisis generally, I thought we might take some phone calls during this conversation from anyone from a former communist country or anyone with regular contact with one, perhaps business contact. Tell us your transition story. How well did the transition to capitalism work in the country you originally came from or that you do business in. What's happening there now as well? 212-433-WNYC. If we have anybody listening right now who feels in a position to tell some of that story from your own vantage point, from your own family's experience, from your business perspective, if you came from any former communist country or if you do business with any of those countries, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692 for Simon Johnson. And Simon, so again, looking back, Russia and Poland and Hungary and Romania and Czechoslovakia, Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, Ukraine, and I'm leaving some out, suddenly began this transition from communist to capitalist economies all at the same time. Did it, looking back now, have some countries been the golden boys of capitalist emergence and others been the laggards?
Yes, certainly some of the countries that I think did a better job of getting the reforms done, Poland, Czech Republic, and Hungary are often held out as strong cases. Slovenia, which came out of former Yugoslavia, has also done remarkably well. And within the former Soviet Union, countries that did more reform have, until recently, done better. So a country like Ukraine, which did less reform, I think would ordinarily be pointed to as one of the one of the problem cases of the post-communist transition. They, by the way, followed a very gradualist approach. I worked with them on policy issues quite a bit in the 1990s. They struggled, tried to get reforms done, and always did a bit here and a bit there, and it just got... It all turned to mush eventually.
So you sometimes had to make compromises at the IMF, settle for systems less capitalistic than you wanted or otherwise not what you thought was in the interest of the people in the country in order to get something done?
Well, I was at the IMF only from 2004. Before that, I worked with countries who were trying to deal with the IMF. I worked with governments in the 1990s, and I also worked with private investors who were actually long the securities of countries under pressure or in crisis, so mm-hmm. people who were betting on recoveries. So I've seen this problem from all different angles. And of course, you know, there are always compromises. You can never get it through exactly the kinds of reforms you want. There's always some sort of vested interest. Powerful bankers, for example, are people who pop up repeatedly. Oligarchs of various kinds, who they may control metal business, they may control some key export sector, they may control banks, again. And so you're always compromising in the policy space, and you're always trying to push, and I think when the IMF does its job properly, it's always pushing countries towards cleaning up their systems, reducing corruption, running the budget better, so there's more transparency, and so forth.
Of course, a lot of countries and a lot of political progressives like to rail against the IMF for forcing countries into hyper-capitalist modes as they see it. Would, and you were there 2000 to 2004, could you say that the IMF bears any responsibility for the current mess because you were encouraging the kind of capitalism that incurred a lot of debt on countries and their economies?
Well, that's a good question, and I think it's a fair question. Just to clarify the dates, I was at the IMF from 2004 to 2008,
Sorry.
And I was the chief economist. That's okay. I was chief economist at the IMF from March 2007 through the end of August 2008, last year. And I would actually say that there was a lot of encouragement of East European countries to take on debt and to try and grow too fast. But that encouragement did not come in the first instance from the IMF. I think there were many of us at the IMF who actually counseled against it and spoke out in public against it. The people who really wanted that approach were the West Europeans. And the European Union, through, for example, the European Commission in Brussels, was saying to many of these European countries, you've joined the European Union, so the so-called accession countries, you're going to converge to West European income levels, you can just go full blast on growth. And we've had countries in Eastern Europe, such as Latvia and Bulgaria, with current account deficits over 20% of GDP. Now, that tells you how much they have to finance as a percent of their economy. That's an extraordinary number. That's a number you've very rarely seen ever in human history. And they only did it because the West Europeans said, look, it'll be fine, and if there's a bump in the road, we'll take care of you. And, of course, what's happening now is there's a massive bump in the road, not particularly the fault of those countries in Eastern Europe, but they were growing too fast. They made themselves vulnerable. And now the West Europeans are kind of trying to avoid catching their eye and shuffling their feet a little bit and saying, you know, why don't you go to the IMF and they'll help you out.
Uh-huh. Now, Simon Johnson, stay right there because we're going to take a break for just a minute. But we have such an interesting board full of callers. We're going to talk to people who originally came from Poland, from Albania, from the Czech Republic, from the Soviet Union, about how they look back on the economic change 20 years ago and the situation today. So stay with us. Brian Lehrer with economist Simon Johnson here on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Simon Johnson, former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. And if you're interested in all this stuff, you want to read his blog, The Baseline Scenario, and the part of it called The Financial Crisis for Beginners. We're talking about the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe 20 years ago and the possible collapse of capitalism, as some people are calling it, in Eastern Europe today. Let's take some phone calls, starting with Bowden in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, I'm a physician. Actually, I once had dinner with Professor Simon Johnson when he was, I guess, a postdoc at Harvard. This was with reference to Ukraine. I think there was a dinner.
And do you work in Ukraine?
Yes, I have a program, and I've brought 46 students here to Harvard, Yale, Princeton, other places, and I've seen the impact of capitalism on them. And many of them wanted to become investment bankers and make money on Wall Street, and that was a big dream in Ukraine. But the issue I want to kind of address today is the public health aspects of all this transformation. When the Soviet Union started collapsing, it was U.S. foreign aid that helped companies like Crimson Capital to move into Eastern Europe and privatize tobacco and market tobacco. And today you will see that in Ukraine, it's the fastest population, fastest declining country in the world.
Now, let me get a response from Simon Johnson. Simon, what about on capitalism unleashing the tobacco trade, for one thing? And then I want to ask you more about Ukraine, because I gather that's considered the most vulnerable country in Eastern Europe right now.
Yes, I think capitalism brings with it many costs as well as benefits, and those are quite apparent to people, and many risks, including health risks, without doubt, that need to be addressed by public policy. And I'm sure the caller is right that tobacco is a serious problem in many countries, and that really needs to be addressed. I think there are capitalist countries that can handle that and the capitalist countries that can't, and so you have to look at other determinants of that. But I wouldn't at all want to underplay the importance of these kinds of issues.
And Ukraine right now, it's very much in the headlines in Europe, from what I've been reading, because it's considered perhaps the economy most on the brink. Is that your understanding?
Well, there's a bunch of economies on the brink. Ukraine is certainly one such candidate. And it has a great deal of political disarray on top of an economic structure that's in big trouble, because they sell mostly metal and other machinery-type parts to Russia, which itself is crashing because the oil prices are coming down, and to other emerging markets, which are coming down because the world economy is slowing. So they're very vulnerable, and their ability to access foreign financing and that is very limited. Their ability to stay on track with IMF programs has repeatedly been a problem in the past. So there's no question that they are vulnerable, and they need to make further progress. And hopefully they'll get more assistance when they make that progress.
Merrick in Westfield, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, sir.
Where are you originally from?
I'm originally from Poland. Came here about 20 years ago. Not fully legally, because of the fact of pretty restrictive American visa policy. And here we are again in 2009, and the same exact visa, U.S. visa policies exist. I mean, I do business with Poland all the time. I sell floor heating. We install that. The website's hosted in Poland. It's being sold here, so I'm back and forth all together, have dual citizenship.
Between here and Poland.
Yes. My daughter speaks fluent Polish, was born here. But I'm thinking, why are we asking from Poles $100 to apply for a U.S. visa and 95% gets turned away?
Well, I hope you'll forgive me. We cover immigration a lot on this show, but we'll save this visa question for another day and a more relevant guest. But since you came here 20 years ago, right around the fall of communism, what's your thumbnail history of your home country of Poland, and what kind of shape do you think it's in now?
It's in excellent shape, and one of the reasons is because of the banking system there is way more conservative than anyone in the West. In other words, it's very hard to get a loan, let alone a loan that is way well beyond your means. Credit card system got there probably about 5-8 years ago, and still very few people would use it on a web. So it is basically pretty conservative because of the fact that where it came from.
Interesting. Simon Johnson, do you agree with that assessment of Poland?
Yes, I agree. I think Poland has had a series of economic stewards, beginning with Leszek Balcerowicz, but also many of his successors who were very careful, and I think the bankers were properly instructed not to take on excessive risk. Of course, everyone is affected by this global downturn. I don't think anyone gets an exemption. But there's no question that within East Central Europe, Poles are in relatively good shape, and I hope that continues.
Because of conservative lending policies, he says. There's a story on Reuters this morning, Simon, headlined, Eastern Europe faces recession, not collapse. Is that the debate in Europe right now, whether Eastern Europe faces merely a severe recession or something much more grave called collapse?
I think that's one fair way to frame the debate. Collapse is, of course, when you can't pay your debts and there's some sort of default, and perhaps that's associated with a big fall in the value of your exchange rate and some prominent bank failures. And I think East Europe can avoid that kind of dire outcome, providing that they get the right kind of support from Western Europe and from the IMF. I think much more pressing and more difficult is the problems that an East European slowdown, even a recession, will cause for Western Europe, because most of the banks in Eastern Europe are now owned by West European countries, and these banks are big relative to West European economies. Take Austria or Greece or even Scandinavia, Sweden. These banks face the prospect of significant losses, and those then come back to be a problem for their governments. You think we have a banking problem in this country, you should look at the situation in some European countries. It's frankly quite scary.
And Besta in New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I live in the United States for 10 years, but I go back quite frequently to Czech Republic, and I just wanted to mention a couple of things. That one of the bigger differences between the crisis, the economical crisis here and there, is the health industry, because in the United States, your health insurance is hooked to your job, so all the people losing their jobs in the United States are at the same time losing their health insurance, and I think that's something that adds a lot of stress to all the people's lives.
And what's the situation with that in the Czech Republic?
In Czech Republic, you have a health insurance provided by the state. It's still, you can say that it's still socialized medicine. So by losing your job, you don't lose your health insurance, which definitely, has much smaller impact on the stress level in your life, and your kids are still insured.
So what do you say to our listeners who are thinking, yeah, but what about the quality of the care?
Well, actually, let's not even go there, because I'm a physical therapist in the United States.
Uh-huh.
But when I am having a major procedure done, I actually opted twice to go back to Czech Republic.
Really?
And the healthcare was excellent. When my son was having a surgery for hernia, we were in the hospital 24 hours before the surgery for observation, just to make sure he will not have any infection or, cold or anything prior to entering the surgery room. They observed him 24 hours before. They checked his blood, his urine, and everything else. When the surgery was scheduled in the United States, we got a phone call Monday evening that Wednesday morning, 6 a.m., we should be in the hospital, no blood work done, no tests done, and that Wednesday, 10 a.m., we'll be back home.
All right, Beata, I'm going to leave it there because we're running out of time. But, Simon, do you hear stories, since you travel, between the continents, do you hear those kinds of comparisons of the U.S. versus even Eastern Europe health systems very much?
Well, I think the Czech Republic would stand out as having a relatively good health system in the former communist world. But I think the very important point the caller was making that I'd like to emphasize is that health care and provision of health insurance in the U.S. is much more tied to your employment status than in pretty much any country at a comparable income level. Now, ordinarily, we might think that's a little bit of a problem, and we've certainly argued about that. But during a major downturn and facing this amount of job losses, it's a catastrophe. And I think this is one thing that the administration has very quickly taken on board and is trying to address.
I could do this all day. We've got calls from Soviet Union we haven't gotten to yet, Albania, elsewhere, but I know you've got to go, and I've got to go to our next guest in a minute. But before you go, you wrote a blog post last week on the baseline scenario saying Europe's problems will arrive at the United States shores. Is it Eastern Europe you were talking about?
Well, it's a combination of the big slowdown in Eastern Europe, also some property market crashes in Western Europe, in Ireland, the UK, in Spain. House prices are falling dramatically. And it's also the fact that the banks throughout Europe, West and East, have become big relative to their economies, and their governments actually can't afford to do a bailout. So you may or may not want various kinds of bailout in the United States, but we can afford pretty much all the options that are on the table. In Europe, they just can't afford it. This is a major problem. It's not being addressed by the Europeans. The new American administration, which has many strong points, has not sufficiently engaged on this. It's not pushing the Europeans. Gordon Brown was in town in Washington recently, and he was going around telling everyone it's a global problem, it needs a global solution. Well, it's not actually a global problem right now. Right now, there's a problem with the U.S. banks that's serious, and there's a massive problem in Europe. It's a European problem that needs a European solution. And it's very much, to just return to where we started this conversation, it's very much about the way that Western Europe took on board and dealt with Eastern Europe. And frankly, it was done in an irresponsible and unsustainable manner.
By the way, I hear that when Gordon Brown was here, he gave Obama some beautiful carved treasure from the UK, and Obama gave him a bunch of CDs, DVDs, and it became an international incident. So just a little comic relief at the end of the conversation. Simon Johnson, former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, and co-founder of the Baseline Scenario blog, which includes the financial crisis for beginners. We'll continue this next week, Simon. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Of course, who knows what those DVDs might be worth in 50 years. They're just the right movies. Coming up in a minute, a West Point graduate and Rhodes Scholar who has written a book on how well he was prepared for actual combat as an Army captain in Afghanistan. And we hear he may even become an Obama appointee to deal with that part of the world. Stay with us.